I mean, I think that the biggest barrier in the equestrian world is still stigma, right? I think even in 2024, many people are still, sort of ashamed to reach out for help and come in for support. And I think sometimes I think it's even more prevalent in the equestrian world. There seems to be sort of this, what I call the suck it up buttercup mentality. Where, in order to do this sport, in order to get on these, large, unpredictable animals, you have to be really courageous. And I think sometimes that aspect of equestrian sports kind of spills over into everything else. And there's sort of this fear that somehow if you need help or you're not doing okay, that it, sort of means, I don't know, maybe you shouldn't be riding, or you're not good enough to ride, or you're not something.
There is a depth and a breadth to our lives that largely goes unexplored. As an equestrian life mindset coach and host of this podcast, I am here to lead you on that exploration. Deep conversations covering topics in and out of the show ring with industry leaders and unsung heroes alike, sharing their stories and what makes their journey unique, but relatable at the same time. We all have stories to share and lessons to trade, something we've learned from a horse or from each other. So relax and be ready to listen with more than just your ears. I'm Tracy Mitchell. Welcome to Hitting Your Stride. Whenever I get the opportunity to talk with someone who can expand my way of thinking and feed my desire to learn, I grab it with both hands and dive right into the conversation. So getting the chance to chat with therapist Megan Pinfield about her work with equestrians was just about perfect for me, and now for listeners of Hitting Your Stride. Megan runs Pinfield Counseling Coaching Consulting in British Columbia and works with riders to understand and overcome their fears. It's a topic that is far more expansive than I just made it sound, and she's been working in the field since 2002, so she's had lots of time to work with equestrians on a topic that can be both daunting and sensitive. One of the most profound things Megan imparted to me during our conversation is that dealing with a traumatic event has a lot to do with who you were before it happened. Since everybody experiences things differently, it makes sense that how we respond to it is based on the platform we're working from. We talk about a lot of amazing things, including her own horse story, the biggest barriers she faces when working with clients, how she developed the basis of her work now, and how she's humbled and awed by riders. I learned so much and still have that craving to learn even more, so I know this episode will be leaving you feeling the same way. It's time to take that first step and begin absorbing her knowledge, so join with me in welcoming Megan Pinfield to Hitting Your Stride. Megan, the floor is yours. All right. Thank you for returning back to Hitting Your Stride, everybody. Today, I have a very exciting guest with me. Welcome, Megan Pinfield, to Hitting Your Stride.
Hi. Well, I'm happy to be here.
Well, this is awesome. You are the woman that I think this time of year, it's always handy to have someone like you come on the show to help prepare or, riders for the season or help alleviate any concerns or just kind of help people with frame of mind and dealing with any kind of issues with fear or anything like that regarding the riding. Would you say this is a busy time of year for you?
I think it's pretty steady. I mean, the thing that I sort of focus on in my practice is riding fear in general, and I don't think that has a season. So yeah.
Very true. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So Megan, without minimizing the expansiveness and importance of your work, can you encapsulate what trauma-informed equestrian coaching is and how you arrived at this specialty?
Yeah, well, as I said, so my passion is really helping riders with fear. And so I sort of started doing that. And, throughout the course of sort of working with riders, I started realizing that, we could We could do a lot of work in session, and we could get them back, on their horse and feeling, more comfortable. But then they would go back into, exactly the same situation, or back on the same horse, or have the same sort of things happening in the arena. And then everything would sort of unravel. And so I started sort of looking at it, from a, sort of a bigger lens, I guess, and thinking, well, if I could get the coaches to sort of understand what's happening for the riders, and get the rider better able to communicate with the coach, then, we'd have a better shot at sort of maintaining everything that we're doing in the office. So I started, sort of researching, what would help. And of course, trauma-informed anything has been around, really since the 70s, when we sort of started recognizing, things like PTSD. So, I think that it sort of came out of just the work that I was doing. And once I sort of started really sort of looking into it, it sort of just had a life of its own, and it kind of grew into this, this series that I've put together for coaches.
That's very exciting. And the fact that it just kind of flowed together, I would always take as a definite, okay, this is meant to be. There's a need here for this, and people need your help.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and I think the coaches are really often grateful, because they don't really often know how to sort of help these riders. They a lot of what you can see about, riding fear online, for example, is, we'll think positive and think good thoughts, and sort of that kind of thing. And that, that's, helpful for some people. But what I've discovered in sort of researching fear and trauma is that that's not really going to work for everyone, because riding fear is so complex.
Wow. Yes, 'cause there's, I mean, having been a rider and stuff, it's like, yeah, I mean, there are those moments where you realize that, you either gotta ditch it or like hang on for dear life. And then once that's instilled in your brain or that certain experience, that this kind of creates a life of its own, does it?
Yeah, and I think that I think it's the one thing that we need to remember about, sort of trauma and fear, is that everybody's experience is going to be different, right? Because everybody's life experiences have been different. And the whole idea about being trauma informed is really about recognizing that all of us, or any of us, could have an extensive trauma history. We all could have past or even present ongoing things that we're coping with. And all of those experiences that we've had in life are going to affect how we perceive the next event we have. So, for example, a riding accident. So, what I'm seeing in my work with riders is that it's not just this fall that has made them, anxious, nervous, or fearful. There's a whole bunch of sort of life experiences that sort of go into whether someone perceives an accident or a spook as, something that is quite frightening and distressing.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of makes you take a look at the real big picture as to why you do what you do.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah.
the thing is that any of us, can have experiences that have sort of negatively affected our thoughts, feelings, behaviors, how we function even in circumstances.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's important for riders and for coaches that we're sort of aware of how trauma affects people, how it affects our brains, and that we're doing everything we can to sort of mitigate the potential for, re-traumatizing people.
Wow. Okay. So before we,
That's a mouthful, I know.
yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's deep, and we're already into the first question.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we get too far away from this area, I want to talk to you about trauma and the various forms it comes in, as well as how you've discovered equestrians deal with it. Can you tell us a bit more about the distinctions between big T and little T traumas and what they can mean to an equestrian?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're asking about this because I think that there's a lot of confusion around what trauma actually is out there. And I think that in equestrian circles, it's no different. I think there's sort of misunderstanding around what trauma actually is. So, to answer your question, first of all, I'm not a big fan really of the sort of big T, little T labeling. And I think most of us that work in mental health have kind of moved away from those terms. So we sort of think about trauma more in terms of was it acute or was it chronic? Yeah, because I mean, if you think about it, right, like sort of telling someone that their trauma was a little t trauma is a little bit minimizing for someone. And so we've sort of stopped doing that. So we've moved away from those and we now sort of think about it in terms of acute or chronic. So acute is sort of, a single incident that was overwhelming. So a car accident or an assault. Or, a house fire, that kind of thing. And then chronic would be things that were more ongoing, that were distressing for an individual. Things like, ongoing child abuse, ongoing domestic violence, even things like living in poverty and having chronic food insecurity, or living in a neighborhood where there was, sort of ongoing violence. A lot of, what we call ACEs. So I don't know, have you heard about, do you know about the ACE studies that were
No,
done?
no.
Yeah, so a lot of what we consider ACEs, so ACEs are adverse childhood experiences. And it came out of a study that was done in the 90s that looked at a whole bunch of different sort of childhood events that contributed to, what we now know are sort of chronic health and mental health conditions. So they actually that was not the original study. The original study was supposed to be looking at what factors lead to obesity, but what they actually found was that all of these sort of ACEs actually have correlated highly with things like stroke, with heart disease, asthma, diabetes, depression, anxiety, things like PTSD even. So ACEs are things like growing up in a household where there was substance use disorder, growing up in a household with any kind of emotional neglect or any kind of abuse, physical, psychological, emotional. So things like that are sort of what we consider ACEs. So all of the ACEs would be sort of chronic trauma. Yeah, and in many ways, the chronic traumas in some ways are worse for us because of typically when they happen. So the younger we are, the more our brain is in that developmental state, sort of the worse it is. And the longer the duration because of how our bodies respond to chronic stress, it's really bad for our health.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't need cortisol, flowing through your
It,
system because,
exactly. Well, and adrenaline and yeah, and everything, right? So there's sort of acute and chronic trauma, and we sort of think about it that way. When riders are sort of dealing with trauma, we're sort of more looking at sort of acute traumas, just because of the nature, of a riding accident, for example. And so one of the things that that's sort of been hotly debated in psychological circles is how we should go about defining trauma, given that we've sort of got, acute and chronic sort of categories. So what I sort of rely on in practice is, what we call the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And it has a definition in it that I think most equestrians can sort of relate to. So I'll read it out to you,
Okay.
and then we can sort of talk about it. So the DSM will categorize a traumatic event as any event where there is the potential for actual or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violence, or where an individual witnesses someone else being seriously injured or killed. Yeah. So just think about every equestrian accident you've ever seen.
Yeah.
How many of those riders thought that they were going to be seriously injured?
Ooh. Well, I mean, over the years that I've been involved with horses, which has been a very long time, and with my massaging and everything, I come across clients that, had a broken neck or a broken back
Yeah,
and have come
yeah.
back from that. But after, and especially knowing I was going to talk to you today and very excited about this topic, it makes me then think back, like, how have they handled it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't think that we, I think this is one of the things that, the riders that come to see me are always a little bit surprised by, is that many times an equestrian accident is experienced as a traumatic event. You know, it has the same effect on the brain and the body as a car accident.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so a lot of what we sort of think of as riding fear sometimes, well, often fits better under the umbrella of sort of a trauma response, right? Like your, I don't know, have you ever had a riding accident?
Yes. And
Yes,
in fact,
I
as
know
you
almost
said,
everybody has, right?
yeah, as you said, as you were talking about that, it took me back to my 10-year-old self when I'd never been on a rearing horse before. And she, I mean, she was huge to me at the time, but I think she was still like just pony size, 14'3" maybe.
That's
But
big enough.
she went up, and not knowing what to do, I pulled her back on top of me.
Yeah.
And I still think about that sometimes. And it's the weirdest
Yeah.
thing. And the only thing that happened was a split lip, thank goodness. But
Wow. Yeah, that's lucky.
It stuck with me for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that would be terrifying.
Yeah.
That way you would probably have thoughts that you were going to die or be seriously injured.
Well, I had like when I at times I'd be trying to go to sleep and I'd close my eyes, and all of a sudden I would have that vision of seeing her falling on top of me.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
that's quite honestly, that's a trauma response, Tracy. Yeah,
Okay.
so I mean, having nightmares about the event, thinking about it when you don't want to be thinking about it, avoiding things that were associated with it. So I mean, a lot of riders, they avoid that spooky corner, or they avoid, going on the trail alone, or they avoid riding with that other horse or whatever. I know these are all very typical responses to a traumatic incident.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So back to the big T, little T trauma, and I completely understand why you and your industry colleagues have wanted to change that. I think what's interesting though is when I was first brought to realize that, because I think sometimes when people think trauma, it's like, oh my God, like it's like,
War.
yeah, those super
Yeah.
huge life-changing things. But then so when I first heard it explained as big T versus little T, it made more sense, and it kind of allowed me to encompass more of my experiences in my life and go, okay, no, that wasn't like big T traumatic, but that still affected me. So that was like more of a little T. But I really like the way you described it, because knowing now that it's
Yeah.
acute or chronic, it, I don't know, it gives you more of a sense of maybe how you can work on it.
Yeah, well, and I think the thing that people really don't get about trauma, unless you're sort of working in the field of trauma, is that so not everybody that has experienced a traumatic event feels traumatized. And so, we know that soldiers come back from war and some of them are just fine and some of them aren't. And it really has to do a lot with, the type of event. So, if you want to use big T, little T, that kind of thing. But also, how vulnerable you were to the situation. So, did you already have a whole bunch of other traumatic experiences in your life before this one? Were there any sort of protective factors? So, we know for a fact that individuals that have strong social connections and good social supports, they recover faster, they do better. They might not even have a trauma reaction to, sort of what you're thinking of as a big T event, right? So it has a lot to do with who you are before the event,
Right.
and what, sort of also what's happening in your brain. Because one of the things that happens with trauma that sort of is not understood is that unresolved trauma in our life sort of compounds. So it's almost like, sort of stacking blocks on top of each other. You have, abuse in childhood, and then later you have a car accident, and then later maybe you have, an abusive relationship, and then you have a riding accident. Well, all of those traumas are going to affect how you respond to that riding accident. And so it's not just, the event, it's the entire system. Does that
Wow.
make sense?
It totally does. And then it just, kind of blows my mind that much more because, I mean, I think generally in the horse industry,
And
people,
so,
sorry, they think that it's something like, okay, I'm a horse person. I have my horses and then I have the rest of my life. But ultimately, it's all interactively and interwoven together.
You can't. I mean, our brains and bodies are connected, right?
Yeah.
And everything that our brain and body has experienced is brought into our riding. And understanding that, we are a complete organism with a whole history of potentially, traumatic events in our life. That's the core of what it means to be trauma-informed.
Yeah.
You need to understand that everybody's experience is different. How people react is going to be different. And it may not be traumatic for you, but it may be for me.
Yeah.
And so we can't sort of even compare. So one of the things that, I see riders doing all the time is, well, my accident wasn't as bad as so and so's, and they're fine. And, this is sort of when I get into explaining, well, but we're all different, right? We all had different, experiences. We all had different upbringings. We all have different brains and different biology. And so it's really comparing apples to eggs, when we start comparing, how we are responding, compared to someone else.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
Does that
There's,
make sense?
oh yes, totally. And there's just so much in here. Oh my goodness. Okay. So we will kind of circle back to some of this, Megan, but I would just like, maybe people to get a little bit more of who you are here. So I'd like to circle back to the beginning of your equestrian experience and find out how you became a horse lover. Can you share with this how your passion for horses came to be?
Well, it's actually kind of funny. So my link to horses actually started with my link to psychology. So I was about 18, and I had actually graduated early and gone directly from high school into university. And I was very unhappy. I never really liked school, so it's kind of ironic that I ended up with 3 degrees, but I think I was probably depressed, and I needed to take some time away from school and figure out, what was going on with me. And I'm not sure exactly how it came to be, but I decided I was going to go take adult riding lessons. So I looked up a local barn and I went off and, I started doing this. And, within a year I had my first horse. Duck was his name.
Aw.
And I rode Pretty much I was there every day for a good year and a half. And then eventually, I realized if I was going to have horses in my life, I was going to have to get a real job and start to earn some money. So I went back to university, and then unfortunately, sort of didn't get back into horses until about 30 years later.
Wow.
And
Okay.
that's sort of how it all began.
Well, that's kind of a cool story.
Yeah, it's funny. I never thought that horses and sort of counseling or psychology, I never thought that I would find a way to connect them.
Oh.
But here we are.
Yeah. And I mean, nowadays, I mean, like the equine assisted therapies and equine assisted learning, have you thought about, taking your knowledge and your education and incorporating that in equine assisted therapy?
Yeah, well, there's actually a lot of equine therapists out here in BC already.
Okay.
And I certainly think that I would love to study that at some point. I'm not, currently trained in that. So I'd sort of try to stay in my lane as much as possible. Yeah, that's a really fascinating area.
Okay.
I don't think it was around back in the early 80s when I
That is true. Yes,
when I needed it.
it's very it's a big thing now for sure. All righty. So, generally
Yeah,
speaking,
much more so.
do you find equestrians to be more self-informed about their negative experiences and better equipped to deal with them? What are some of the barriers you commonly find you have to deal with when working with someone new?
Wow, yeah. I mean, I think that the biggest barrier in the equestrian world is still stigma, right? I think even in 2024, many people are still, sort of ashamed to reach out for help and come in for support. And I think it's even more prevalent in the equestrian world. There seems to be sort of this, what I call the suck it up buttercup mentality.
Yep.
Where, in order to do this sport, in order to get on these, large, unpredictable animals, you have to be really courageous. And I think sometimes that aspect of equestrian sports kind of spills over into everything else. And there's sort of this fear that somehow if you need help or you're not doing okay, that it, sort of means, I don't know, maybe you shouldn't be riding, or you're not good enough to ride, or you're not something, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think stigma is still really the biggest barrier. I mean, even if you think about like some of the phrases that get passed around in the equestrian industry, like I don't know, if you ever heard of any of these, but like I've heard things like, it's never the horse's fault. It's always rider error, right? Have you heard that
Yep,
one?
for sure.
Yeah. And so really this sort of translates to, well, whatever's gone wrong, it's your fault, right? So, this sort of thinking about it in your head, there's a lot of self-blame, a lot of shame. We also, say things like, well, if you can't handle a fall, you shouldn't be riding.
Yikes.
Right? And
Yes.
what kind of message does that send to a rider that's, maybe struggling with their mental health or feeling, fearful, right?
Yeah. I mean, what about the good old fashioned? I mean, heck, it was drilled into me as a kid. And I mean, I'm sure many more. I'm not sure as far as like kids nowadays, but it's like you get a fall. What do? You get right back on that
Get back
horse.
on. Yeah.
So,
Yeah, and I have a big problem with
okay.
that. I don't think sometimes that traumatized risers should be getting back on, not until we've sort of resolved some of that experience for them. Because if you think about it, if your nervous system is activated in a way that, you're in a state of fear, and then we put you on a horse who's really sensitive to what your state of being is, what's the likely outcome of that?
Yeah, not good.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. And yet we still tell riders, well, get back on and do it again. Right. So I think there's this sort of, as I suck it up buttercup, or, if I can do it and survive, then you should be able to as well. I don't know whatever you call it, there's sort of an attitude that, you need to be tough. You need to be tenacious. You should be, able to handle this. And I think that that does a disservice to riders. And I think
Absolutely.
it's, yeah, I think it's, it makes it tough for a rider that's experiencing fear or anxiety or depression or anything else,
Because
to
it's
talk
kind of
about it.
ironic that, so many of us, and I mean us as collectively as horsemen and women who have been drawn to these incredible animals for partnership and for learning, I find it ironic that, we're usually drawn to them for our own healing,
Right.
and yet there are these
Yeah.
moments where we almost, not sabotage ourselves, but put ourselves in these situations that ultimately aren't the most healing-esque, right?
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. I think that I think a lot of us, just like myself, you sort of gravitate towards horses because we get something that really heals our soul from them. But then at the same time, the messages within the industry can sometimes be, telling us the opposite, that we're not okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, not only does the industry, kind of sending messages, aka with your horse and without your horse, but also too, I mean, when you were talking about a lot of pressures, depending on the circles in which you're riding, but a lot of it now is like the high-end VA shows or, all of these kind of things. Like, there's a lot of expectation, and I've got to be careful because we might be touching on this in a question or two. But like, even the what you wear, what your horse is wearing, like all of this
Oh
kind of
yeah.
stuff, like that plays a big part too, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And I find it, kind of funny. If you think about like Equestrian Canada, and they in 2021, Equestrian Canada adopted the READY principles, right? So reconciliation, equity, diversity, inclusion, and if you think about inclusiveness, and then you think about, all of the expectations and the in-groups and the out-groups and the, well, you can't be this kind of trainer and you can't use that kind of method and all of the sort of messaging, within the sport, a lot of it seems more divisive than it does inclusive.
Yeah, a lot
And
of
I think that, to go back to the sort of trauma piece, if we're going to work towards ready, if we're going to work towards reconciliation, if we're going to work towards, being an inclusive sport and welcoming everyone, we need to make it safe for people to talk about their mental health and talk about, what's not going well for them and what's, how they'd like things to be different.
Yeah. Wow. This is a wonderful conversation. It's jam-packed with a whole bunch of stuff that's very important. This is awesome.
Yeah, therapists don't tend to be surface level talkers, do they?
No, and I love that because anybody who knows me, I love meaningful conversations. So this is awesome. Okay, so Megan, in the last 10 years, you've been in private practice and specializing the work you do with equestrians. What are the trends that you've noticed that keep coming up? And now that you have a significant body of work to draw from, how are you able to gauge the impact of it?
Yeah, I mean, since I've sort of specialized in fear, I think the trend is that everybody has it. I don't think it matters really where you go or who you are or what level you're at in the sport. The one thing that we all have in common is we've all been afraid at some point. And so there, if you want something unifying that, makes us all, equal and inclusive, it's the fact that we're all afraid at times. So everyone, I think, has experienced that. And one of the things I'm trying to do is to take a look at things in a bit more of a scientific way in my practice. So right now I'm conducting a research study in collaboration with Vancouver Island University's Fear and Anxiety Lab. And we're taking a look at the psychological effects of equestrian accidents. And so I'm really hoping that, if we can actually get some good data on this about what's really going on for riders when they have an accident, and what are the symptoms, how long does it take them to get over it, what does that look like, what are the things that are working for them, what doesn't work, if we can actually get some, real sort of evidence of this, we're going to be able to sort of have better treatments. We're going to have, be able to advocate for services for riders, mental health services, and better things like that. So, I'm really hoping that, we get some riders filling out the survey that's going to be out and, looking at things in a different way.
Wow.
I think one of the things that's, a bit challenging about being in my line of work is that, like, when things are going well for riders, they don't come in. So,
Yeah, I could see there'd be like,
right? When things are going well, I
yeah.
don't see my clients. So, they're out there doing their thing. They're out there riding.
Now,
So I
are
don't, often know how the story ended or, what happened, unless I sort of happen to, see them on at a show or something.
Huh. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of the case with most things, right? Like, I remember, like, over the years, if I've gone in and done some talk therapy with a psychologist, it's been, yeah, just like, okay, this is good. Thank you. But then it was an opportunity where I could go back and have some more sessions. And my therapist was like, okay, so, what do you want to talk about? Like, is everything okay? And I'm like, you know what? Everything seems to be fine. Like, I'm fine. But I just had this inner feeling like there was more to sort of unearth. There was more for me to look into and, like assimilate or accept or, change about where I was at in my life at the time. So, it's fascinating because yeah, I could see that they help you help them with such and such an experience and then they go on. Have you ever had people come back that have been like, nope, Megan, I need to like we need to deal with
Oh
this
yeah,
more?
for sure. Yeah. I tend not to sort of close the door on clients because life is life, right? And you may do a piece of work with a client and they go off and they do their thing and then something else happens. And so they come back. So sometimes they'll like shoot me a message on email or something and say, "Hey, this happened." Which is always nice, but it doesn't happen very often.
Now, do you feel like in your sessions with these said riders that, go off and then maybe contact you again, but do you feel like you've maybe given them significant tools enough that they are okay on their own?
Yeah, so when a rider, just doesn't make appointments, it's usually because they got what they needed. And so, usually as a therapist, you can sort of see that that's the direction things are going because, they're out there, they're trying, more things, they're riding more, they're doing the things that they couldn't do before. There's a whole series of steps that have been achieved before, they, decide not to rebook or don't come to the last appointment or something.
But I'm sure it's nice for them to know that, like you said, your door is always open, so that they can always feel welcome to reach out to you.
Yeah, always. There's
Okay.
always another accident,
Yeah.
or there's always another spook, or
Oh my goodness. That's so true. All right, so I come across perfectionism a lot. I'd have to say I'm a recovering one. And, people that I coach in my life coaching for equestrians business, Equestrian Elements, they deal with this stuff a lot too. So, how do you get someone from that frame of mind to become more resilient instead?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, resilience is such a big topic, as you know, I'm sure you're aware. And it has so many different sort of contributing factors, right? Like, you know, I'm thinking, you know, self-compassion. I'm thinking about cognitive flexibility. I'm thinking about, you know, self-esteem. I'm thinking about all of the different pieces that have to be in place in order, you know, to be resilient. But I mean, when I work with clients, you know, we often look at, you know, sort of how our early life experiences had a part to play in, you know, whether our brains wired themselves to sort of look at the world, you know, and relationships and other people and, you know, situations as, you know, unpredictable, chaotic, frightening, or whether the brain got wired to sort of look at the world and see it as, you know, generally safe and supportive and, you know, reasonably manageable. Right. So we're sort of looking at, well, how did we get to a place where perfectionism sort of felt like the solution, right? So I think that, you know, oftentimes, you know, perfectionism sort of comes out of a bit of a fear of not being able to control things, like our life. So feeling, you know, a little bit like the best way to reduce our anxiety about not knowing how things are going to go is to sort of control what we can control, right? And that's, you know, typically our, you know, performance, our product, our, you know, whatever it is that we're producing. A lot of perfectionism, you know, sort of can come from, you know, what our parents never said overtly. So, you know, kids interpret things in ways that we don't necessarily intend as an adult. And I'm speaking as a parent here, who has a 23-year-old son. That, you know, what we say to kids and what they hear is sometimes, you know, very different. And so sometimes some of the things that parents say get internalized, as expectations, when maybe they weren't, you know, really intended that way, right? So, you know, the example I always use for clients is, you know, if you're a small child and you're looking for validation and you show your, you know, artwork to your parent, and your parent says, you know, what most parents would say, which is, you know, oh, that's a lovely picture, honey, but the sun isn't blue, it's yellow, right? I mean, that's just a normal sort of parent thing to say. And yet, for a really sensitive child, you know, what they might hear is, it's not good enough, you did it wrong. And so, if that's the message they hear and that gets, you know, sort of internalized, you know, those core beliefs, you know, can really get solidified, and then the outlook on life becomes, I better do it perfectly, otherwise I'm not acceptable. Yeah. And that's sort of, you know, that though those core beliefs are, you know, it takes a while to really, first of all, help someone understand that that's where that comes from, or that where that, you know, sort of developed. And second of all, to change that, right?
So what would you say, I don't know, how do I want to ask this question? What do you say to the parents of those the littles, the pony kids, the ones that are, bopping around on a pony every Saturday taking their lessons? Or how about those little ones that are, showing the A shows and, all dressed up to the nines and with the expectation? Like, how do you help prepare parents to help prepare their kids?
Yeah, well, I mean, if I had parents in my office, you know, what I would say is, so instead of saying something like, you know, why didn't you make the sun blue, or why did you leave that stride out, I would say be curious instead. Be curious rather than critical, right? So, you know, instead might maybe say something like, you know, tell me what you were thinking when this happened. Or when you left the stride out, what was going through your mind? So getting the child to sort of reflect on what worked and what didn't work, rather than sort of making a comment about, an evaluative comment, right?
Yeah.
So
Okay.
I think it's not that, like, parent, we don't intend to sort of do these things.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly not blaming parents. As I said before, kids are great observers, but they're not always the best at interpreting, right?
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Ah.
And we're
Okay.
all doing, the best we can, right? Like
Yes.
as parents, as riders, as coaches, in any given moment in life, we're all doing the best we can with the tools that we've acquired in life so far.
I think that's been my motto for a really long time.
Yeah, it's a
Yeah,
good motto to have.
absolutely. I mean, I'm sure as, adults, any of us can look back and go, kind of wish my parents didn't do that or it had been done differently. But yes, through the process of understanding that, it's made things a little clearer for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
Okay.
I'm already saving for my son's therapy. I'm sure that he's going to have lots to say about things that I've done.
Ah, I know. Like, yeah, like you said, we can only do what we know and the best we can. And yeah,
Absolutely.
awesome.
Absolutely.
All right, Megan. So you designed the self-compassion oriented resilience building program. I love it. While you worked for Simon Fraser University. Tell me more about that and its application to the work that you do.
Oh wow. Yeah, that was a long time ago. That was 2014 now.
Wow.
A lifetime. Yeah, SCORB was developed. SCORB is sort of the short how I call it. And it was designed to sort of help alleviate the demand on counseling services, because we had, just an overwhelming demand for therapy for students. And so I tried to design something for that specific purpose, and then what came out of it, was a dissertation, a PhD dissertation. But I think that self-compassion, which is sort of the foundation of SCORB, that's an essential life skill, really. It's something I think that we actually should be teaching in schools. So self-compassion, if you're, I don't know, are you familiar with sort of Kristen Neff's work on self-compassion?
No. But
Yeah, so
I am very aware of, and especially in the last few years, just telling myself to just be gentle with myself and do stuff like that. Yeah.
So self-compassion, the way that Neff sort of conceptualizes it sort of contains three core elements, right? So in order to be self-compassionate, we need to first be able to be mindful, right? And I mean mindful in the therapeutic sense. We need to be able to be here in the present moment, focused on what we're doing right here, right now, right?
Yep.
Without letting our thoughts wander away and sort of do their own thing. Two, we need to be able to be kind to ourselves when we're having moments of difficulty, right? So just like we would, treat a friend, we need to treat ourselves just as kindly, right? So be mindful, be kind. And then the third element of self-compassion is really choosing to see yourself as part of the human race, right? As part of a shared humanity. That we are no different really than anyone else on the planet. So we're not better and we're not worse, right? So one of the things that we tend to do is to sort of compare ourselves to other people and imagine that other people are coping with things much better than we are. And so when we can maintain this sort of belief that, yeah, we're okay. We're no better. We're no worse. We're the same as everybody else. Nobody's coping better than I am. Nobody's coping worse. Right? When we can have all three of these things, life gets a little bit easier because we're able to deal with the one thing that's not going well right now. It's not everything in my life is awful. It's this line or this, pee off or this, movement in riding or this ride even is not going well, but it's not everything. And I'm coping with it as well as anybody else would be coping with it. It's just what it is.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Totally. And, and it's funny because I think as a society, probably, especially with social media and everything looking perfect in everybody's world, so you kind of walk around, and I'll just say, I might walk around some days going, oh my God, like, am I doing enough? Should I be doing more? Or I've got this going on. And then, I see so many people in a day. I might, have little chit chats here and there, and I listen to them and I have compassion for them. My heart goes out to them because they're dealing with something too. And
Oh,
it
yeah.
the levels could be way more intense than what I'm going through. And it's like, not to make their situation sound light, but I kind of say to myself, you know what, Trace, you're doing pretty good. Because you're handling this, you're handling that. And it's not that it's nice, but it's nice to know sometimes that you're not the only one going through things. So if you can share and, like you said,
Yeah.
have that compassion or empathy for people, I think that's pretty important.
Yeah, and it fits really well with sort of a trauma-informed view, right? Where everybody is dealing with their own stuff and everybody's history is their own. And so what one person finds challenging may be easy for someone else and vice versa. And so we really can't compare ourselves to other people, right? So being self-compassionate really helps with perfectionism because, sort of it gives us the freedom to be good or good enough, not perfect.
Love it. Okay. So this year you began delivering your first trauma-informed coaching workshop series in British
Yeah.
Columbia and have said it's now being offered throughout Canada. Is this something you'd like to see Equestrian Canada take more of an active role in promoting to get it put into use more widely at all levels of the sport?
Well, actually, yeah, Equestrian Canada has been quite supportive of this program. And we have sent it all, they've sort of assisted in sending it out to all of the provincial equestrian associations
Nice.
to make them aware of it. Yep. So about a month ago, I had a call with all the coaching leads from all the provinces. And they're right now, I think that they're just recommending the program. It's not a mandatory program. I think coaches have enough mandatory things on their plate,
Right
but
now,
they
yeah.
are we are offering professional development points for it.
Nice.
So that's good. And I sort of suspect that what's going to happen in the next few years is that we're going to see the Coaching Association of Canada sort of pop up with some kind of trauma-informed training of their own. It'll be more general. It won't be equestrian focused like what I've designed, and it won't obviously have one of the things I teach is what I call my safe ride system, which is a system for teaching or coaching riders who have had an accident and how to bring them back from that accident. So Safe Ride is an acronym, but so it won't have those pieces for coaches, but it will, sort of probably give the basics of what it means to be trauma informed. And that's because we're seeing that organizations, the school systems, and other sports are all sort of adopting a trauma-informed coaching lens out there. And I think that Equestrian, Canada is going to have to follow suit. So we'll see.
Yeah, I would agree. And I would think even like in Ontario, we have Ontario Equestrian has something called the GRIT program, which stands for Great Riders in Training. And it's a really awesome program that involves two very iconic riders that stem from here in Ontario, Christelotte Boylan and Ian Miller. And it's for all of the disciplines of eventing,
Yep.
jumping and dressage, and they bring them together, and there's group coaching and there's physical, training, and it's really cool. But yeah, I would think that something like that would be, as far as the mental health for the riders, would be something that would be really helpful to have them work and, kind of work through your workshop series.
Yeah, and I think that, since Equestrian Canada has sort of adopted the READY principles, I think that it is going to be sort of inevitable, because if you think about it, we can't really become, equitable, diverse, inclusive without first sort of having a psychologically safe space within the barn. And we can't really have a psychologically safe space within the barn if we're not trauma informed, right? So I think that they sort of all kind of go together and lead up to, becoming more, more diverse, more equitable, more inclusive, and ultimately working, towards reconciliation, which is, our mandate.
Yeah. My goodness, is there anything that you can share with us? Obviously, there's client confidentiality, but could you share an experience of something that a rider dealt with that, and how they came out on the other side?
I mean, I can sort of generally
Yeah.
talk about it.
Yeah.
So I'll share what I use as a teaching sort of case. So this isn't a real case, but it's not an unlikely situation, and it's something that I think a lot of riders sort of go through. So, it's not uncommon for riders that have had accidents to sort of have a trauma response. And because of the way their nervous system is responding to that, do something called dissociating. So dissociation is essentially when your brain kind of checks out of the present moment. So it's sort of the opposite of mindful. And it kind of goes somewhere else to sort of protect itself in a moment of, trauma or severe distress. And what I see in riders is a lot of dissociation, typically when something's going wrong. So the horse is, starting to get agitated or starting to, get upset. And if there's been some kind of traumatic event in the past for that rider, they're more likely to sort of dissociate in those moments. And so I've worked with many riders that have had dissociative experiences. Sometimes they dissociate, for every jump. Sometimes they dissociate because the coach is yelling, and they associate yelling with, childhood, issues and abuse.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes they dissociate because, the feeling of their horse's back coming up underneath them is associated with a bucking spree. So you can have all sorts of, sort of trauma responses like that. And we do EMDR, or I do EMDR for many of these things. And if we can keep the client sort of able to sort of keep one foot in the present moment and one foot in the trauma, usually we can desensitize that so that that doesn't happen anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, Megan, last question. How has dedicating yourself to this work changed you and how you view being an equestrian?
Oh, honestly, I'm really humbled and in awe of riders everywhere. I think, looking back, when I decided that I wanted to sort of work with riders with fear, I actually thought it was going to be easy. I had my own fear issues as an adult coming back into riding, And I, worked with lots of clients on fears about, car accidents or fears about flying or fears of spiders or dogs. And so I thought, oh, it's going to be, it'll be easy. It'll just be like that. And, we'll just, do it. And now, after doing it for 7 years, I realized riding fear is incredibly complex and it involves so many different factors. And it involves, three, sometimes four individual beings all at the same time with their own agendas.
Wow.
And yeah, and looking at riding fear through the lens of a researcher as well as a clinician, I realize now how much I actually don't know about it. I sure I can help people, but there's never actually been any studies done on what happens to riders psychologically when there's an accident. So yeah, so I'm sort of humbled. I also think that equestrians are courageous individuals just because they get on horses, just because you get on. If you think about, the natural sort of fear response, like our innate inclination is to avoid large animals, that could eat us or hurt us. It's to avoid pain. It's to avoid, anything that's a fast moving, object or a fast moving ground coming up to meet you in the face. And to sort of avoid anything that's, dangerous to the body, right? And yet we do it every day. Every time we get on a horse, we're being courageous.
Yeah, it's just my regular listeners will have heard me say this already, but I had recently done some, continuing education in the coaching world, and I took a course, based on values, and therefore I took the values questionnaires and stuff, and
Oh, yeah.
I put risk taking as one of my least imparted or engaged value. And then yet it kind of hit me that
Yeah.
I rode horses for a large part of my life. And yeah, that's crazy. And yeah, so I guess I'm more of a risk taker than I thought. So I don't know what it is as horse people. And it's so funny because we are such a unique type of person.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel really privileged to work with all the riders who come through my door.
Aww.
They're amazing individuals, and anyone who's willing to, do the hard work of therapy so that they can continue to get on their horse. I mean, that's the epitome of commitment to the sport, right?
Oh, I love that. That's a beautiful statement. It really
Yeah.
is. Yeah. Wow, Megan, this has been jam-packed. I can't believe it's been an hour. I feel like, we've just,
Wow.
yeah, I know. This has been amazing. Thank you so much. Your information is definitely important for all riders to hear. I think all people. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, you're focus has become on riders, and very interestingly so, because, like you said, I think a lot of the times, out of the old school way of doing things, you fall off, you get right back on again, and you just keep going. And I think that's sort of a scary recipe for us perfectionists that, you
Yeah, and I'm
know,
not sure it's working for us anymore.
no,
Yeah.
it really isn't. I think it's time to do something new for sure.
Yeah.
So just before we go, because there might be some people thinking of this question. So for the maybe more old school type of coach, or when a rider does fall off, whether it's an 8-year-old or a 38-year-old or older, what do you suggest the coaches say to these people instead of getting right back on? What would you say the process is?
Well, I think the first thing is to do a a concussion screening. And
Yep.
I think that I often hear stories from riders that the coach doesn't screen, only screens if the rider says they've hit their head. And
Okay.
that's actually that's a mistake, right? Because we know that the force with which a rider hits the ground is enough to jar the brain in the skull, regardless of whether they actually hit their head. So I think that we need to sort of get into the habit of concussion screening automatically for every fall. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think it really needs to be a conversation between the rider and the coach about how that rider's feeling about getting back on. Because a lot of riders will actually comply with whatever their coach tells them because they want to be a good, a good athlete, right?
Yep.
And certainly anyone who has a trauma background, has grown up, with, for example, abuse or something, they're not necessarily going to speak out and say, I don't want to do that. So I think that we need to be a little bit sensitive to that. And that's what being trauma-informed means. It means that you recognize that about individuals and, you ask.
Wow. I have had a lot of conversations. I think you are my 78th conversation.
Wow.
And I know, and but I think this has got to be the one that really puts the importance of change in the industry up to the forefront of dealing with the mental health, which has become such an important topic over the last years, few years. But yeah, I mean, I knew I was talking to you today. I've read your bio. We've emailed back and forth, but this has like really hit me. I'm just like
Wow,
so important for
I'm
everyone.
happy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Megan, I cannot thank you enough for this. How can people get a hold of you if they have any questions or concerns? Now, yes, you are out in BC. I am in Ontario, but we have listenership across the country and into North America, down to the States. Is how can people reach out to you?
Yeah, you can find me on my website. That's probably the easiest thing to do. And it's PCCC, so the letter P and then three C's, dot CA.
Okay.
The link for the study is there as well as all my information. I'm also on Instagram, and my Instagram address or handle, I'm never sure what the kids are calling these things, is under your helmet. So under your helmet. And I
Okay.
post all sorts of tips and things about mental health in equestrian sports.
Perfect. All right, Megan, thank you again.
Well, thank you.
This has been wonderful.
Have a great week, Tracy.
Thanks, you too.
Bye.
So there you have it. I have some great interviews lined up for future episodes, and we'll be covering some pretty interesting topics, as always, with the intent to open and engage the horse world on a wide variety of issues. So until next time, keep your eyes forward and continue to hit your stride. To stay current with Hitting Your Stride, subscribe on my website or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you like what you've heard here today, make sure you share and leave a comment to help guide future episodes and widen the audience. And be sure to check out social media to keep up to date with Equestrian Elements Life Coaching.